Welcome back. Coming up on this week's show, we discuss USA's performances during the October international break, ESPN versus CBS's coverage of the US men's team, our thoughts on the Newcastle United takeover, how DAZN's coverage of the UEFA Women's Champions League is going so far, and your feedback in the listener mailbag segment. I'm Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, joined alongside my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar. Kartik, this week, Kyle Fansler's not available. He's working, busy editing a video. Actually, we've got two this week. So last week, we released the interview with Mark Donaldson from ESPN. And he's doing two more interviews this week. And we will release the next one probably by the time most people download this podcast. So probably Thursday or Friday. And that will feature either Derek Ray or Christian from the Cooligans. So stay tuned to worldsoccertalk.com for that. Now, Kartik, for me, this international break has seemed like the longest one ever. By the time it's wrapped up, it's almost 2 weeks. A lot of the teams that have played in this international break have played three games, which I think you would agree is one too many. We're actually recording this on Thursday. There's still a whole set of international games to be played tonight from CONMEBOL. So a lot of these players from Brazil and Argentina, etc., won't get done until late Thursday, and then they'll fly back to Europe, those that play in the European leagues. And I'm not sure if you know this, Kartik, but Real Madrid have postponed their game. They had a game scheduled on Sunday, and they've postponed that because they said a bunch of our players are not going to be back in time. Or they'll be back, but they're not going to be ready to play this game. I don't see any solution for this, other than maybe Arsene Wenger with his crazy plan. But what do you think, Kartik? What's your sense on this whole international break?
Yeah, I'm tired of it. Look, I think the three match days crammed into one break in some of the regions has created all sorts of unintended consequences. And although I shouldn't say they're unintended, I think they were probably perfectly clear that there would be these sorts of knock-on effects before these decisions were made to cram in these matches. And I think you could have still had the World Cup draw potentially over the summer and used the June break for qualifying or for intercontinental. Well, I guess the intercontinental playoffs will be then, but the June break for that, and then have quick intercontinental playoffs after that, and maybe do the draw in August. Because, I've been reluctant at times to criticize the U.S. manager, Greg Berhalter, because I understand how difficult it is. A lot of fans don't seem to get this, how difficult it is to play every 3 days with a squad you've just assembled and travel great lengths. It's not necessarily an easy trip from Austin to Panama City and back to Columbus. Same thing with how Canada's had to travel, Jamaica, everybody in this region, Costa Rica, etc. And it's creating a ripple effect for European football. And there was even the decision taken by the U.S. I mean, part of the U.S.'s problem down in Panama was not having specifically Anthony Robinson on the left side of defense, who, of course, he's playing very well for Marco Silva at Fulham. He makes that trip to Panama. He can't play for Fulham for 2 weeks. So he would have to quarantine, so now managers are in difficult positions. We saw Jamaica maybe their chances for World Cup qualification were dealt a fatal blow by being on the UK red list. And about half their squad plays, or maybe a little less than half their squad, but a lot of their key guys are UK or English-based, not able to make the trip for the first international break, including Lowe, a player you're very familiar with, Chris. So, I think it's just created all kinds of complications. That Liverpool-Manchester City match, which was one of the great matches we've seen in world club football in recent years, one of the great dramatic events, you would like something to follow up on that quickly. Now, that match feels like it was a month ago. And the momentum that had been gained. Also, I talked about Serie A I spoke about how good Serie A has been the last few weeks, right before the international break. That momentum is lost. So I don't know. I just wish there were a better way. And yeah, you make a point, Chris, about Wenger's plan. Wenger's plan does include, I don't like the every 2 year World Cup, but it does include kind of this block off period where you play club football straight through and then you have your internationals and your qualifiers. Maybe that is logical. I just wish it wasn't within World Cup every 2 years, but there has to be some sort of way to mitigate these international breaks. I mean, keep in mind, last point, we used to have an international break in August. We used to have one in February also, which were midweek breaks that gradually got eliminated, which I thought were good things. But now looking back, maybe if we had had those an August match day with one match, a midweek match, and then a similar thing in February this year, we would have been able to avoid all this cramming of matches in September and October and November and March. The March break is going to have three matches as well.
I think part of it is the complication of international games in general nowadays are a lot more complex than what they used to be. So you have players now playing around the world. They may play their club football in Europe or in South America, but then their national team is, you know, vice versa. I mean, they might play club football in Europe and have their national team in South America, or vice versa. Or you mean we look at, you know, like the United States, you have players that are playing in leagues, you mean mostly in Europe and in North America. So you have players traveling long distances. You've got COVID, which is still an issue. It used to be, Kartik, I'm not sure if you remember this, but it used to be that oftentimes for international games, club football would happen on the weekend. You'd have an international game on a Wednesday night, and then, you mean, then the club football would return on the weekend.
Yeah, that's specifically what I'm mentioning about the August and February breaks. They were done that way. Remember, there wasn't really a break in February, but you would have a Wednesday match. And then same thing with that August break. There wasn't really a break, but you would have – it was mandatory release, right? So there would be no club football during the week that week. And all the matches and leagues would end on Sunday. There would be no European or continental competition. And there would be no Friday match, right? You would have a Saturday match. But that – and I used to hate that, Chris. And that's why I was an advocate and pleased when FIFA got rid of those two dates, the February date and the August date, which happened – the February date was eliminated 2008 or 2009, and then the August date was eliminated, I believe, in 2011 or 2012. So it's been a while, right? It's been over a decade or more for both. I think maybe that's the solution, right? If you're going to keep this format, because what has ended up happening now is this just log jam in September and October, and as I said, we're going to have it again in March.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though, too. You mentioned Wenger's idea of trying to combine these matches into kind of a bigger block of time, and then it wouldn't be an international break. It would be an international sabbatical. We know how long an international break feels. Imagine 2 months kind of all these games being played. It does affect things. I mean, because there are fans of club football, there are fans of international football, and there are fans that like both. It is two different universes. I mean, there's a lot of people that I think don't really follow international football that much, other than maybe their own country, and then the rest of the time they're checked out. So, club football, when club football's in the swing, it's happening. It's practically almost a daily event. There's always things happening to your club, whether it's press conferences, whether it's managers being sacked, whether it's League Cup football, and then you have another cup game coming up, and so the international the club football flow to me is more exciting, it's more entertaining, and then the international break, that flow is just it's very much, okay, training, boring, nothing really happening, a game's played, and then training, nothing really happens, a game's played. It's very monotonous. Thank God. Yeah. Thank God club soccer is back this week. And like you said, too, that Liverpool-Man City game was fantastic, entertaining, controversial in terms of James Milner staying on the pitch, but a great game to watch. And when you look at the schedule of the season calendar, I mean, the Premier League and other leagues do that on purpose. They almost always pick, you mean, that last game before an international break, they almost always have a big, big game scheduled on that day. And I mean, Liverpool Man City was one of them. And that's, yeah, now it's almost like starting all over again with this weekend. Yeah, Watford against Liverpool, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, pretty quickly, we'll get right back in it. And before you know it, Kartik, it'll be November again and straight back to international break.
Yeah. And at least in CONCACAF, the international break this time will only have the two matches. For the U.S., it's a match against Mexico in Cincinnati, very difficult match, and then a trip to the office down in Kingston against, I believe, a renewed Jamaica side after getting their players now released from England. Kamar Roof had a nice goal yesterday, by the way. As we record this on Thursday morning, former Leeds United player, now star for Rangers, for Steven Gerrard and Rangers. But again, South America is going to have three matches, and we're not going to really get into the flow of the season. I mean, Serie A in particular, maybe it was because Serie A started a week later than the other European leagues, or 2 weeks later than Liga 1, that they didn't seem like Serie A really hit the flow until that weekend of Atalanta and Inter and the Rome Derby, right? The Lazio-Roma match. And so then Serie A, who's on a new network in this country, right? New style of coverage from CBS has captured us the last 2 weeks, and then boom, there's this break. And I have a feeling we're going to have the same thing, right? Serie A, Premier League, La Liga, Bundesliga gear back up, and then another break. It's terrible. And I complained about the international breaks before, Chris, as I think you have and many others have. But it's never quite been as bad as this year because of the three match days, because of the situation with South American qualifiers, with the situation with red list countries, where, for example, I'll just use the example of Villa. Aston Villa, Buendia is a big signing for them this past summer from Norwich. Because he went to South American qualifiers and had to quarantine for 2 weeks, he hasn't actually integrated back into the squad. And he's a new player who was getting more time before the September break than he has since because he had to quarantine. And then he comes back and Villa's playing well, right? And so Dean Smith's reluctant to really change that team around. So it's hurting guys also.
So let's take a look briefly at the coverage of the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers, specifically the US. And we're not going to go into a lot of detail about the games themselves because most of us have already, I mean, we've watched them. It's in the past. Everyone's been talking about those games in terms of, pluses and minuses and criticisms, etc. But let's talk about the television coverage because I don't think that's really been focused on much at all. And it's interesting because in terms of the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers, ESPN and Fox both share the rights to the U.S. home games. Now, the away games are the rights to those are with Paramount Plus and CBS. The only exception is the Mexico away game, which I believe either ESPN or Fox has that one. But so it is a split, and from this past week and a half, Fox didn't show any games on this one. But we had the USA against Jamaica on ESPN, ESPN2, and then we had Panama against the USA, which was exclusively in English language on Paramount Plus, and then USA against Costa Rica on ESPN2 and ESPN Plus. Kartik, what's your take on the differences? Because they are very different, completely different styles, but kind of maybe pluses and minuses of CBS versus ESPN and how they broadcast, how they televise games featuring the U.S. men's national team and their analysis and commentators.
Yeah, and let me preface this by saying I have CBS's coverage of Mexico, El Salvador on DVR, and I have not watched it yet, so I we'll just keep it specific to the U.S. because I did want to talk a little bit about CBS's coverage of the rest of CONCACAF, particularly on a night when they don't have the rights of the U.S. game, but didn't get a chance to review that yet as we record this on Thursday morning. So maybe we'll do that in the future. In terms of the U.S., I think that there is a an effort by CBS to be very fanny. That's a bad term, right? Very fan-driven, right? Very much U.S.-oriented, have former players who are fans, but also have some understanding, or actually I would say a higher level of understanding of how difficult internationals are, how difficult travel is, how difficult CONCACAF is versus the average U.S. fan. But I was disappointed in the coverage of the Panama game in that we didn't get any analysis of Panama before the game. None. But we got far more discussion of what was what we might see from the U.S., what the psychological factors might be, what the external factors in the camp might be, than we did on ESPN, both on Thursday, the previous Thursday night, and then the Wednesday night with the pregame show, which was Seb Salazar, Jermaine Jones, and Casey Keller. Now, I should point out for the Jamaica game on Thursday, that pregame show was bumped to ESPN Plus, whereas on Wednesday it was actually a lead into the match broadcast on ESPN2. The flip side is when you get John Champion and Taylor Twellman in particular, you have a lot of understanding of the opposition. And I think particularly the Jamaica game, because John Champion has called matches with a number of those Jamaican players, right? Because so many of them play in England or have played in England previously. So he was very familiar with that squad and a number of the players. And then the guys who have not played in England generally have been guys in MLS or USL who they're both Pullman and Champion are very familiar with. So they gave us more perspective on Jamaica. And again, maybe I'm sensitive about this because of where I live in South Florida, but there are lots of Jamaica men's national team fans in particularly where I live in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale area, that will probably end up complaining about the broadcast on Paramount Plus next, or CBS Sports Network, wherever it is next month, from the match down in the office, because they probably won't emphasize and talk about Jamaica as much as ESPN did in their broadcast of this game.
Hey, Kartik, let me just chime in just for a second, because that USA Jamaica game, so the number of viewers on this one, which is interesting, ESPN2, I think, had 597,000 viewers. That's just off the top of my head. And then Univision, I think it was on TUDN/A and Univision, or was it Unimas and TUDN/A? But anyway, Univision, the Spanish language broadcast of this game, was over 1 million viewers. So USA against Jamaica, obviously there are in South Florida, there's a large Jamaican population, and throughout the U.S., there's a percentage of that population, but it's relatively small. So when it's USA against Jamaica and Univision has almost double the amount of viewers. So again, that could be bilinguals, that could be Spanish language speakers who are American, who live in the United States. But I just wanted to kind of add that in terms of the context.
That's kind of stunning, actually, because these are two English language speaking countries,
right?
And the United States, right? Predominantly English language. Obviously, Jamaica is all English. The U.S. is a bilingual country, majority English. That is a surprising number. And when I mentioned Jamaica national team fans in South Florida, there are a number, but I don't know that there is. I mean, they might be the people watching on ESPN, actually. And I think from my own conversations with Taylor Twellman, he's conscious of that, Chris. He's very conscious, which maybe the guys at CBS aren't as conscious of, that there are fans of the opposing national teams when you're talking about CONCACAF. Maybe Champion and Twellman may treat a match against a European opponent or an Asian opponent a little differently if they don't have a big population in the United States. But Twellman, I can tell you, is very conscious of the fact that there will be fans of Jamaica, fans of Costa Rica, fans of Honduras, whoever, watching the match against the U.S. And
right.
So he does gear his commentary to, yeah, it's a U.S. broadcast, but I know a percentage of the audience is interested in what Theodore Whitmore and Jamaica are doing.
Well,
I don't quite think CBS has that awareness or that interest, maybe, in the opposition as of yet.
what I would say is that when I watch CBS's coverage, to me, when I'm watching it in the studio analysis, it leans slightly more to Fox Sports than it does to a, say, an ESPN. And the reason I say that, too, is that it is very much USA, USA. Let's talk about USA. Let's not really talk about the opponents. Or if we do talk about the opponents, let's not go into detail because we're not as familiar with that. And it is, I mean, Moadu, who also works for Fox Sports, Kate Abdo, who used to work for Fox Sports, and you got Charlie Davis, or Davies, who you could see him easily fitting in with a Fox type of broadcast in terms of just a former American footballer just talking about, you mean, the passion for his team and his country and his analysis. So that leaning slightly towards that Fox side of the kind of the umbrella is not a good thing. That's the thing about the USA. The Panama USA game at halftime. The first half was just a horrible performance by the United States. Lackless, just lifeless, really. And going into that halftime analysis in the studio there with Paramount Plus, there was no energy. It was very flat. So I think part of it, too, is that, the cast, other than Kate Abdo, they're all American. So they wear their hearts on their sleeves. And so because that U.S. performance in that first half was so lacking energy, the analysis we got in the studio was lacking energy. It just was kind of like, oh gosh, this is, I would like to see somebody that would be more kind of more critical, or maybe more like, hey, here's what's going on, here's the problems, and have a little bit more energy in that analysis.
Yeah, I think also part of this is you have broadcasters who, right, Kate Abdo is the exception, right? And she's very cosmopolitan. But you have broadcasters that don't at the current point in time in that studio. Obviously, Drake Cordero is calling Serie A matches and has called matches from around the world. But in terms of the studio, people who are calling matches from other leagues around the world or have that eye that they're seeing things outside the U.S. or outside the CONCACAF bubble. So this returns me to ESPN and Casey Keller. Casey Keller is both on the world feed and on ESPN's coverage of the Bundesliga. He does a lot of Bundesliga matches. Now, obviously, there's a big chunk of the U.S. team and guys who are U.S. MNT eligible who haven't been called in recently, like Julian Green and Joe Scaly and others that are in the Bundesliga. So that gives him kind of, I think, a broader perspective about the U.S. player pool and then also what the expectations should be for play. So I come away from this international break. I don't want to get deep into it on this podcast. You can listen to me on any number of other things I've been on or will be on the remainder of the week about the U.S. to get my opinions into play. But I felt like people and broadcasters were overly negative after Sunday's match, overly hard on Berhalter, overly not understanding what the larger context of things. Similarly, I think after the Wednesday match, people were overly rosy on the national team and critical enough of the performance and some of the flaws in the tactics and the squad selection. So again, that goes back to your point of halftime of the CBS studio, could have been Fox, as you mentioned, that there seems to be this emotional roller coaster just based on results and on score lines and matches and not enough critical analysis of what's actually happening in each match. So, yeah. That I guess maybe that's the case with every national team, because I've complained about it with the U.S. A lot of people tell me, hey, you're right, but you should check out what it's like with the Mexican national team. You should check out the reaction to the German national team in Germany. And I know, for example, what happened in Germany is people stopped watching the national team, right? Their television ratings, domestic television ratings plunged as negativity reached an apex. We've seen that in the U.S. too,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
The ratings you just cited, those were better for ESPN, that Jamaica game, but still half the viewership of Spanish language. And we've seen for friendlies that the numbers just completely bottom out and a lack of interest. And so, I think it's to be continued, this narrative. CBS, let's also dial it back for a minute here, Chris. CBS is new to this. They've just dove headfirst into the international game. Obviously, they've now been broadcasting the club game for a few seasons, but I get the sense that they'll they'll tweak and adjust. And we've seen that even with their Champions League coverage. We even saw that with their Serie A coverage, which I think is dramatically different in October than it was in August already.
Yeah,
2 months
and better.
So,
yeah,
yeah, it's a lot better. So.
What I would say, though, Kartik,
what
I would say is one of the reasons why I think the analysis is all over the place and the hype. I mean, basically, everyone's kind of just like hypersensitive to these games and kind of it's like a roller coaster ride, really. The first part of it is, I think, desperation. And it's desperation because we know that we missed out on the last World Cup. And it is more important than ever for the U.S. to qualify for the 2022 World Cup. Reason being, not only because of the United States, but because of the growth of soccer in this country. I mean, we know that the 2018, by not qualifying for that World Cup, that hurts the growth of soccer in this country. Whether they're fans of the U.S. national team or not, whether they, I mean, basically kind of the new people coming through, whether it's younger generations or if it's casual sports fans and they come across the World Cup, that is often really kind of the almost like the birth time of soccer fans or people becoming soccer fans every 4 years. So that's the first part. The second part, why the analysis and hypersensitivity is all over the place, I think is the hype factor. You go back in the last 12 months, whether it's Gio Reyna, Christian Pulisic, I mean, Tyler Adams, and you go down the list, the hype factor is off the charts as far as, I mean, Sergio Dest, etc., off the charts. By the hype factor alone, in terms of just the way that CBS, Fox, NBC, I mean, everyone is talking about these players, writing about these players, interviewing these players, talking about it on Reddit or Twitter or Facebook or whatever, those hype charts are way off. I mean, they're way, way, way high. And then the reality is oftentimes is, yes, these are young, skillful, talented players, but the reality doesn't live up to the hype yet. It could in the future, perhaps, but it's not like, it doesn't happen overnight. And it does take time, and there's no guarantee that it's going to happen. And I think that's part of the reason that why the analysis is that roller coaster ride. When the U.S. wins, it's okay. Isn't this great? These young players, can they go all the way? Look at how great they are. And when they lose or tie, then it's like, oh my gosh, the coach, what was he doing? You know, why isn't he doing this? Why isn't he doing that? And I think that's where we're at. And a lot of it is based on everybody wanting the U.S. to qualify for 2022. It's that important.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that that's creating this hypersensitivity. But there's also the thing that really galls me is that even after not qualifying for 2018, there seems to be a disrespect of CONCACAF opposition among the U.S. fan base and some in the U.S. media. Panama finished ahead of the U.S. last time with many of these same players. Let's not forget. Costa Rica, I think, is kind of long in the tooth. Their time is done. Whenever I mention the quality of the Canadian team, I get all kinds of pushback. People basically in disbelief that Canada could have the quality of players that they have. And Alphonso Davies, I think anyone who our friend Juan Arango has been championing it too, right? I mean, there's no comparison between Alphonso Davies and any other field player in CONCACAF right now, mm-hmm. At the club level or the international level. So. It's frustrating, but I do understand why there's this urgency and why there's this kind of panic whenever things go wrong and this euphoria when things go well. Although I think I could very easily make a case that those results could be reversed, that the U.S. would have lost to Costa Rica at home had certain things not happened, Navas having gotten hurt. There had been a clear penalty. I feel there's no VAR in CONCACAF, a clear penalty call that Costa Rica would have gotten late in the first half. Flip side, Panama, yeah, the U.S. was terrible, but the one goal came off a set piece and an attacker losing his mark on the set piece, and very easily the U.S. Could have gotten a goal on the counter. There were a couple opportunities late in the match. So it is what it is, I suppose.
Yeah, and going back to the ESPN versus CBS in terms of who's doing a better job of covering the U.S. national team, at least for these few games here in October. For me, I mean, the commentators, I mean, John Champion and Taylor Twellman are better than Dre Cordero and Mo Adu. I mean, I mean, Cordero and Adu are good too, obviously, but Champion and Twelman are in a different league. But I would say, though, Kartik, that even though I was criticizing CBS's studio coverage before, I think CBS's studio coverage is better than ESPN's coverage. And the reason why I say that is that I've been really disappointed with Jermaine Jones. I thought he was going to be a lot better. I thought his accent, delivery would have been a lot stronger. It's a little bit, you have to listen really closely to what he says, but it's really difficult to understand him at times. He doesn't have that passion and energy that we did see that when he worked, I think it was on Fox, actually, a couple of years ago when he did one of the games. He was really, really good. So I'm not sure what happened in between. The other thing, though, too, is that I like Seb Salazar and I like Casey Keller, but having them in the stadium and trying to provide their analysis, and you're hearing in the background the sounds of the fans and the game, and it's distracting. It's really difficult to listen in and hear their analysis when they're at the stadium versus when you go back to a studio and there they are, and it's kind of in a sterile environment, and you get to listen to them. So I would say that definitely on the commentating side, ESPN is doing better. And then on the studio side, I actually would say that CBS is doing better than ESPN, at least for these U.S. men's national team games.
Yeah, there's always a question as to whether you want to have a studio at the venue, a pitchside studio, or whether you want to have a studio. And that's an ongoing question in broadcasting live sports. It's something ESPN has actually grappled with. I mean, they have obviously their, I think the thing ESPN covers the most extensively is college sports, and they balance the two, right? The game day crew being on campus and being at the big game versus the studio that just gives highlights and analysis that's sitting in either Bristol, Connecticut, or in Charlotte, North Carolina, and they hash it out from there. So that's I think there's almost like a balance where maybe ESPN needs to add a Bristol studio element to it, and CBS needs to add a pitch side desk element to it. Although CBS's commentators are not typically at the game, so that's a whole other story. So
yeah,
this is to be continued in November, I think.
Yeah.
As we have two U.S. games, one's on CBS, one's on ESPN too. So we'll have this conversation again.
Well, that's a good point, though, Kartik, because I definitely, and I think most of our listeners would agree with this, though, too, is that we definitely want to have the match commentators at the game because they can see things that we can't otherwise. And a perfect example of that was Wednesday night in the game USA against Costa Rica, and Taylor Twellman mentioning that Serginho Dest was in it was off the pitch right by the byline there.
Right, keeping
the game on
was a good goal, Twellman. Whereas if you have commentators who are not at the match, you're still not clearing that up until halftime, probably.
Exactly, because you're not seeing. Obviously, that was something that happened where if he wasn't in the stadium, he probably wouldn't have seen that Serginho Dest was like right behind the goal there. Versus being in person, seeing it, observing it, and then getting Mark Clattenburg to share his thoughts about it. That was some really good stuff, and that's something that we were missing. We're missing when it's Dre Cordero and Mo Adu in the studio, and it's a bit awkward too because you have Mo Adu oftentimes in the studio giving his pre-match analysis, and then he's like, "Hey, okay, I gotta go join Dre Cordero," and then they're in a stellar booth giving the match commentary. It's not as good. I mean, and so there's definitely room for improvements on both sides there, Kartik. All right, let's move on to our match to watch this weekend. Kartik, what's your recommendation of the must-see game?
Yeah, West London Derby, which is Brentford-Chelsea. First time this match has been played in the top flight in at least 60-some-odd years. I believe they played a couple times in the second division when Chelsea was relegated. Chelsea was frequently relegated in the late 70s and early 80s. But first time in the top flight in the Premier League in history. Two near neighbors, Brentford's new stadium. They've already been a story of the season. Chelsea, I think, has the advantage now, technically, in the title race, because they have not dropped a single point to a non-top four side, whereas City, United, Liverpool have all dropped points. Liverpool's dropped points were to Brentford, actually, have all dropped points to non-top four sides. That having been said, I do stick with my prediction that Liverpool was this the best team in the Premier League and City is a close second. But at this point, based on what's happened in the season, Chelsea have the advantage. This will be a real test for them. And I have to say this as someone who knows a lot of Chelsea supporters. Chelsea supporters always were very contemptuous and dismissive of Fulham as a local rival. But when Queen's Park Rangers, those few times they came up into the top flight, there was more of a derby feel for them and more of a, we hate QPR, we hate, you know, we can't stand them, that's our rival. I wonder where Brentford fits. Does Brentford fit into the Fulham category or do they fit into the QPR category? Or are they the happy medium between the two? I guess we'll find out starting on Saturday.
Yeah, the other thing about this too, Kartik, an advantage for Chelsea, I think, is that fewer players from South America. So international break, you look at Liverpool and Man City and the number of players that they have in their squad from South America and whether or not they'll be able to play this weekend and their recovery time versus Chelsea players, a lot of them, I mean, whether it's Africa or Europe, but probably less travel distance coming back to their game. And then my recommendation for this weekend is Juventus against Roma on Sunday, 2:45 Eastern Time on Paramount Plus. For me, Roma is a joy to watch, not only because of Jose Mourinho and his antics running up and down the touchline, but also Tammy Abraham, who is continuing to grow into improving as a footballer. We saw him even this past week playing for England. And he's really on a hot streak right now with Roma. And coming up against Juventus, I'm looking forward to watching that one on Sunday, 2:45 Eastern Time.
Yeah, Juve has very quietly and made hard work of it, but they have turned their season around. They're grinding out results the last few weeks. They haven't played. I don't think their performances have been particularly good. I don't think, to me right now, they don't look as good as maybe four or five other teams in Serie A. There are a lot of good teams in Serie A. Juventus is slightly behind those teams, I think. But they're getting results now, and that's what Allegri teams do. We have to remember that. It's been a few years since we've seen Allegri manage. But his teams aren't always easy on the eye, but they get results. So this will be a good contrast. And actually, for those who haven't watched Roma, this idea that Mourinho parks the bus and is going to be very negative, haven't seen it yet. They've been very fun to watch.
Yep.
Very open in their play.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to TV streaming news, Kartik.
Yeah, Atta Football has announced a new partnership with the UEFA Women's Champions League, their global rights holder, broadcaster DAZN, to make games available to paid subscribers. Atta Football will stream 31 tournament matches over the course of the group stage round of 16, quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals to its paid subscribers. Matches will be available live at Atta Football and at DAZN's new Women's Champions League YouTube channel. And by the way, saw a lot of Atta Football this week with their coverage of the WSL, which always takes center stage when the men are on an international break. So they're doing a lot of good work in consolidating. And we did an interview with them now probably over a year ago, Chris. And their goal always was to consolidate as much women's football onto a single platform as possible. And they're well on their way to doing that.
Yeah, next up is ESPN, the television network, probably won't consider a direct-to-consumer streaming service until the pay TV bundle falls below 50 million U.S. households, according to a report on CNBC last week. At that stage, industry experts argue that Disney could likely make more from a full-service sports streaming service than it would make in a wholesale pay TV distribution model. ESPN currently has 75 million TV subscribers. So what they're talking about here is that, okay, 75 million TV subscribers, and if you subscribe to, you mean, cable or a satellite company, even if you don't watch ESPN, part of your subscription fee, a large part of it, is going to ESPN and ESPN2 and the ESPN channels. And right now, if ESPN said, you know what, let's go ahead and take our channel, the ESPN flagship, And let's put that on streaming, just as available streaming directly to consumers. At this point in time, it doesn't make sense for them to do that. But if that 75 million TV subscribers falls below the 50 million TV subscribers, then at that point, they might make the change. They might make the switch and say, you know what? We can offer ESPN, the main channel. I mean, the one that has, I mean, not ESPN Plus, but the main channel. And that will become the option to subscribe to that directly, bypassing the cable companies, bypassing the satellite companies. ESPN would be confident at that point that they can make more money from that than they could from just the TV side. So it's going to happen. And it ultimately, does ESPN Plus become ESPN just by itself? And that is the streaming service that has the ESPN TV channel, which has a lot of games that are not on ESPN Plus. Although the two of them are kind of morphing a little bit, though, Kartik, especially with the U.S. men's national team games. The U.S. game against Costa Rica, that was on ESPN Plus. The U.S. game against Jamaica was on ESPN Plus. And then next month's game, the U.S.-Mexico game, is on ESPN2 and ESPN Plus. So slowly but surely, or actually very quickly, they're starting to morph together anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, they certainly are. And I think what Disney's strategy has been from the beginning, and we got a little insight into this now. Gosh, it's probably been about 3 years. It can't keep track of time anymore with COVID, right? Seems to have blurred our recognition of time. About 3 years ago, we were up in Bristol, you and I. And the sense I got from that was that ESPN Plus wasn't a service meant to supplant of ESPN in any way and to placate cord cutters. It was actually just a supplemental streaming service, which is maybe why they've kept it so cheap. Now we see since other supplemental streaming services, Discovery Plus, same thing with Paramount Plus and Peacock, among others, HBO Max, those launch. But there is a certain degree of those services, I think, being more useful for cord cutters maybe than ESPN Plus is, right? ESPN Plus is just supplemental material for now.
Yeah, it's interesting though too because I mean this USA Mexico game that's going to be next month in November. Normally, if we went back say 3 years ago and ESPN had announced USA against Mexico World Cup qualifier is going to be on ESPN2, the whole world, it seems, or at least the soccer world in the United States would have gone crazy. I mean, would have said like, "This is ridiculous. This is USA against Mexico. This is a World Cup qualifier."
Disrespectful is what they would say.
Completely, and they'd say like, "Why is this not? Why is this not on ESPN?" And well, it's because of college football, probably. But people would have been freaking
that
out.
That is the reason, actually.
But right. But last week though, so last week when ESPN announced it, and we covered this on WorldSoccerTalk.com on the website, ESPN announced the game will be on ESPN2 and ESPN Plus. And I think by having it available also on ESPN Plus, that diffuses the situation. Those people that are upset that the game's not on ESPN, hey, it's on ESPN Plus. Everybody gets ESPN Plus already. No big deal, right? It just as ESPN Plus is almost as accessible as ESPN is. And I think the way that ESPN's been doing this is such a smart strategy overall as far as ESPN Plus. I mean, they will keep increasing the price, probably a dollar. We started at $4.99 a month. We're now at $6.99 a month. And I think $6.99 a month for the value that you get for all the La Liga games, all the Bundesliga games. Now it seems all the US games, mostly the out-of-market MLS games. You go down the list, there's a ton of content. And every 6 months to 9 months, they'll probably increase it by another dollar. So I guess the question is that what is that point where that price point, is it $12.99 a month? You mean, are we happy with paying $12.99 a month for ESPN Plus? Now, if that also includes every single Premier League game, yeah, hell yeah. So what, Kartik, what about you? What's your price point? What's your point where you kind of say like, ESPN Plus, it's too expensive now?
I don't know because I've I'm a bad person to ask. I keep signing up for these things. So I really have to trim my bill because it, between Peacock and All Access, Paramount Plus, ESPN, the whole Disney bundle, the HBO Max, et cetera, I'm paying a lot for streaming services. I mean, I even have an add-on to Amazon Prime, a Starz channel for movies. So I keep saying I need to cut. And I think what I was going to do was cut Peacock this year and just didn't do it. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe if it got to $12.99 a month, that would be a cutoff. But right now it's $6.99. It's not a to me, that big a deal. I think I probably would absorb a couple more price hikes before canceling.
I guess part of it, though, too, is how much are we paying for Netflix right now? And I think Netflix, for me personally, which I have an account that has, I think, four or five people that can access it. So each of my kids have their own login. I think I'm paying, with taxes, I think $18 a month. And I don't watch much Netflix. Now, my kids do. My kids love it. No. My wife watches it all the time. Well, not all the time, but she watches it a lot. So if I said to the kids and to my wife, hey, I'm canceling a Netflix, it'd be chaos. It'd be like riots in my house. And $18, I think, is, you know, so whatever Netflix goes to, the argument could be made that ESPN Plus, that price point for the value you and I get and the listeners get, if we're sports fans, which we are, obviously, it's on a par to that. So, I mean, ESPN will know what that cutoff is. They will look at those numbers. They will continue to analyze those numbers and seeing how many people go ahead and cancel their subscriptions as a dollar is added per month. You mean whenever they do the price increases, so they'll know kind of like, hey, all right, let's stop here because you mean it, anything more than this, it's going to actually hurt us rather than help us. And just a couple more news items, Kartik. We talked about ESPN, and we've talked about ATA Football. Well, NBC, in their latest viewing numbers, NBC Sports reports that they are averaging a total audience delivery of 608,000 viewers per Premier League match window this season. That's up 31% compared to last season, and it's the best season opening for the Premier League viewership since the 2015-16 season. So far, so good. And that's really with Pulisic being injured, Ronaldo coming back. The 31%, I wouldn't put as much of a emphasis on that just because of everything that happened last year with the pandemic. But so far, so good there for the Premier League. And NBC, of course. Let's move on to the listener mailbag. First up is Aza. And he says, I know it's very early to talk about the TV schedule for the 2022 FIFA World Cup. And Kartik, this is a good one for you, more than for me, really. Aza continues, I was wondering if World Soccer Talk will publish an article about how the NFL and other sports programming might affect the TV schedule for the World Cup on Fox and FS1 as it's being played in November and December. And this is something that keeps on changing, right? As far as, you mean, NHL moving from NBC to ESPN, golf coverage moving from place to place. But really, it comes back, circles back more to the NFL and college football, from what I can understand. But Kartik, how much of an impact do you think having the World Cup in the winter in 2022 from November to December is going to have on scheduling for Fox and for FS1?
Oh, massive issue for Fox, which is why FIFA very quietly extended them through 2026. Let's keep that in mind. So I think that it's a real challenge for Fox where they're going to fit all this stuff and how they're going to fit it and timings, etc. So. And they don't have as much bandwidth necessarily as other broadcasters. So, this probably will end up in a print article, Azer, sooner or later on World Soccer Talk. It's just we're still more than a year out.
Yeah, and let me just look real fast as we're online here. And let me see. I have the TV schedule here for the games. So, for example, if we look at 2022, which seems so far away, but it really isn't, right? The group stage. A lot of the group stage games, with the time difference between the United States and Qatar, now these kickoff times would be Eastern time. So let's look at a Saturday, which would be a Saturday and a Sunday, which would be big days for college football on a Saturday, and a big day for college NFL football on a Sunday. The first weekend that's going on a Saturday and a Sunday in November, which happens to be Thanksgiving weekend also, but the Saturday, the kickoff times are Eastern time, 5 a.m., 8 a.m., 11 a.m., and 2 p.m. And that's the other thing, too, with having so many teams in the 2022 World Cup. There's going to be more games. So you've got four games spanning from 5 a.m. Eastern time, which is not going to be a big deal, but all the way through to about 4 p.m. Eastern time. And that's just the games themselves. That doesn't include, of course, shoulder programming. Now, on the Sunday, which would be a big NFL day, same thing again, too. So 5 a.m. to about 4 p.m. So I guess the issue is going to be the scheduling. More so is going to be those afternoon games on the Saturdays and on the Sundays. So the 11 a.m. Eastern time and the 2 p.m. Eastern time would be the ones that would be the big issues. And if Fox has college football and has NFL games, then where does it go? I mean, you're right as far as kind of the overflow. You mean it, like they have FS2. But that's pretty scary. I mean, they've got Tubi, but it is going to be an issue.
Yeah.
All right. Next up is Jason. Jason says, I just read a ESPN article about how Kevin De Bruyne injected himself with painkillers during the Euro tournament in order to play. This brings up fixture congestion, the issue again. Do you think that the major leagues should reduce to 18 teams? It is a big reason why I think the Bundesliga is good, reasonable to manage players, and easier to follow. Imagine if the Premier League becomes what it is now, minus Norwich and Newcastle United. Not much of a loss, plus four less games, with television coverage becoming streaming based now. I think it is doable. What's your take, Kartik, on the number of teams in a league?
I've been an advocate for all the domestic leagues dropping to 18 teams for a while now. And FIFA had pushed that more than a decade ago, and it didn't really happen. But I, the top flight leagues, because of the fixture issues, I've actually been a pretty strong advocate of that, and have worked out through the years a number of scenarios on how the Premier League, or how the system in England could implement that over the course of a number of years, number of seasons. You wouldn't drop to 18 immediately, but you would balance the leagues, the lower divisions, in such a way that you get there in three or four seasons. But I don't think that there's as much momentum for it now as there was maybe a decade ago. There was a lot of talk, though, that Germany's international performances reflected the fact that their players were fresher because of the longer winter break due to the 34-match season versus 38. But that conversation has faded as Germany's international fortunes have faded.
So I'm not sure if you caught that, though, to Kartik. Jason mentioned Newcastle United, not much of a loss. And you, as a Manchester City fan, having gone through, I mean, you've been a City fan since the early 80s, and having gone through your club being bought out by, you mean, Thaksin Shinawatra, a very controversial figure, and all of the issues that circulated around that, and perhaps you can give some a little bit of a recap about that as a City supporter and what those issues were. And also the other part of it, too, is it didn't happen overnight, right? It didn't happen. Success didn't happen overnight. It wasn't as if the buyout came for Man City and all of a sudden they were, you mean, winning the Champions League final and winning the Premier League. It did take time for City to build themselves into the club that they are today, which is a major player in world football. And this circles back to Newcastle United and the Premier League giving the approval for the Saudi sovereign states to go ahead and acquire, take over Newcastle United, which it has happened. The first game under the new owners will be Sunday. Another game to watch this weekend, definitely Newcastle United against Spurs. And it looks like Steve Bruce will be in charge for that game. But you, as a Man City fan, what's your experience, but also what's your thoughts on Newcastle United being taken over by the Saudi sovereign state?
Yeah, I think it's very important that Newcastle United stay in the Premier League because there's a geographic question now that Sunderland are down and Middlesbrough are down. Borough could come back up, but Sunderland aren't going to be back up in the top flight for years to come. So that's important to me. Yeah, as someone who went through the dual takeovers, right, because we were taken over by Shinawatra, the former Thai prime minister, in 2007, and then Shinawatra at a desperate time because his assets had been frozen. There were all kinds of concerns about his human rights record. He couldn't bring money into the United Kingdom and spend it on Manchester City. So Manchester City went through a pretty big spending spree in the summer of 2007. Sven-Göran Eriksson was attracted as the manager. Then it all went bad. And at that point, Shinawatra, desperate to sell the club, ended up in contact with someone named Amanda Staveley, who fixed up Shinawatra with the Abu Dhabi, with Sheikh Mansour and the money from Abu Dhabi that transformed the club. And Staveley played a huge role in that. And so there's actually a direct connection to the Newcastle takeover, because obviously she was the driving force in this takeover. Unlike with City, it appears like she's going to stay on and help manage the club. In the case of City, there were some growing pains. So the takeover happens. There is a lot of spending that's done in the 3 or 4 days between the time it became inevitable that the takeover was going to happen and the takeover happened. Robinho was famously remembered, but there were a number of other players brought in that period. And City found itself in the relegation zone, sitting 18th after Boxing Day. This is a team that had qualified for Europe. We were in Europe that season also. We qualified for Europe based on the previous season. We're in the UEFA Cup and had a good season under Sven-Göran Eriksson. But again, the takeover and the assets being frozen, all of that had a calamitous effect. I should mention a number of players were sold also. So it took a season, and then that second season we finished fifth. And that was a season where players were being bought very haphazardly, right? And Mark Hughes was the manager and spent a fair amount of money on former players of his, like Craig Bellamy, Roque Santa Cruz, guys he was comfortable with. It wasn't really until, I would say, the second half of, or the tail end of the 10-11 season, which included winning the FA Cup. So that would have been three years into this takeover, that things really kind of settled with City. Now, with Newcastle, I think Newcastle is in a place where they're less successful, right, at this moment. Manchester City had been relegated several times. That's always talked about, right, in the 90s and early 2000s, and that somehow success was bought. But by the time the Abu Dhabi takeover took place, Chris, City had been in the Premier League for several seasons in a row. And as I said, had finished in the top half the previous season before the takeover and had qualified for Europe and was in the UEFA Cup. And we actually made it to the quarterfinals of the UEFA Cup that year. So we were, some of our problems that season, the year of the takeover, were like the problems that often teams that qualify for now the Europa League, which is the successor tournament to the UEFA Cup, have when they don't have a deep enough squad to balance both. In terms of the Newcastle takeover, look, I don't like the Saudi Sovereign Fund coming in. I'm, as a political person, very critical of Saudi Arabia and the relationships that of all of the U.S. presidents, Clinton, Trump, Biden now, have had with the Bushes, and particularly the Bush family, have had with Saudi Arabia. But I think it's unfair to say, hey, Newcastle, this is where we're drawing the line. You're a club in desperate need. You're one of the few remaining really attractive clubs for foreign investors. I would put Leeds on that list, Aston Villa. Although Aston Villa now has, with Wes Edens and that ownership group, a fair amount of money. Everton obviously got sold recently, a few years ago now, to Mashiri. So Newcastle is really one of the last remaining gems out there. So we allowed a takeover for Everton. We allowed a takeover for Manchester City. We allowed these real scoundrels who don't violate human rights but profit off of all kinds of other stuff to run Manchester United and run Arsenal. Arsenal's ownership, Kroenke, so much of his money is Walmart money, which is made off of exploitative practices, child labor, the sorts of stuff that liberal people who are complaining about Saudi Arabia would complain about if they connected Kroenke to Walmart, which they haven't done for whatever reason, or at least not many of them have. So I think it would be grossly unfair for Newcastle not to get the investment. So I don't like the Saudis being in the league. At the same time, I think it's great to have a team from the Northeast that's going to be uber competitive from here on out.
Yeah, I'm on board there with you, Kartik, in terms of your opinions about. I think that this deal had to happen. I mean, with the, if you're going to reject this deal, then the Premier League should have rejected similar deals in the past with other clubs. It's a tough situation to be in, but it moves forward. The thing about this though too is Newcastle United. I think for the most part, I think fans kind of have a. There's a likability about Newcastle United in terms of the fan base, the Geordies, and being a one club in one city thing, which is rare. I mean, Leeds United is another one. I mean, of course, Sunderland is close to Newcastle United, but Newcastle United is a big city, a one club city, and a huge fan base, and it has a lot of likable players in the past, a lot of likable managers. And I think success won't happen overnight, but it'll be interesting to see what happens and how they proceed in terms of selecting a manager and then players and how long it actually takes to get to make them into a success. I wonder though, Kartik, because a lot of the criticism about say Chelsea when Chelsea was acquired by Abramovich and other teams in England, Man City being another perfect example. Where a lot of fans to this day still criticize, like, oh, Chelsea, well, they bought the league, or City, they bought the league. I guess we'll get the same criticisms about Newcastle United, but I just wonder if we're in this time now, in 2021, where those things, I mean, you almost have to pay huge amounts of money to be successful. And the less money you pay, for the most part, going back to soccernomics, the less money you spend on players and wages, etc., you're going to get less success. Whether or not there'll be the same level of criticism for Newcastle United as there would have been for Chelsea when in quotations marks, they bought the league or City bought the league. What do you think?
Yeah, and it's not that simple, right? The thing I learned as a City fan is it's I criticized Chelsea back in the day, not realizing how difficult it is to actually win the league and then maintain that level. And City at times have gotten stale, right? They've kept guys too long, right? Because the club ethos is a little different. I think clubs like United and Arsenal were very adept at moving guys on when their usefulness had run out. Now, Arsenal now is a mess, but I'm talking about Arsenal during the peak Wenger days.
Right.
Very adept at getting guys out the door. I think both Chelsea and Manchester City, because the clubs came from a different place, there's been almost a sentiment that has led both clubs to hold on to players for too long. And you're seeing it. You could argue, see it with City now, right? City bought one player this summer. That's it. It was Grealish. Obviously, the goal was to get Harry Kane also and buy a second player. But in fact, there's someone, a friend of mine who is an Arsenal fan who admires Manchester City. He tells me, look, I love the fact that you kept Yaya Toure for so many years. You kept Vincent Kompany for so many years. And you kept David Silva for so many years. Arsenal doesn't do that anymore. Arsenal has never really done that since Wenger came in, right? He inherited the core of the George Graham, Bruce Rogers teams that he kept for the first few years. But then once he started bringing in his own players, guys were cycled out, right? If they were 28 or 29, they were moved on. So it's not that simple. And so I think we need to be very tolerant of however Newcastle chooses to do this build.
Next up is Nick. Nick says, the international break has proven that, at least for me, soccer burnout is the main reason why I don't watch MLS. I'll usually watch anywhere from 1 to 3 matches on a Saturday or a Sunday morning or afternoon from the different leagues around Europe. By the time the evening comes around, I'm usually almost always ready to do something else, or at the very least, watch something else besides sports. This international break had very few games I was interested in, nothing really besides the semifinals and the final of the Nations League. When the evening rolled around and MLS was on, I found myself watching and enjoying the games since I hadn't watched any sports all day. I'm only one person, but I think that this shows that for me, MLS is in competition with the big European leagues, even if it doesn't clash with them directly. Unfortunately, MLS isn't able to compete with those leagues, as the only thing that it offers that they don't is the opportunity to go in person, which doesn't have anything to do with their TV product. This translates to good match day attendances, but poor TV ratings. I don't say this as a MLS hater. I would like the league to do well, and I would like to support it more myself. Unfortunately, there just aren't enough hours in the day, and MLS have enough to take my limited TV watching time away from European leagues on earlier in the day. Yeah, some good analysis there by Nick. What I would say, though, Kartik, just to counter that, though, is MLS is back. And MLS is back, which was an audacious effort, a huge pull-off. They were able to pull it off, Major League Soccer, in combination with ESPN. They had games. They had games played in the morning. And it was, I mean, for the first time ever, you had MLS scheduling games to be played at, you know, what was it, like 8:30 in the morning or 9 o'clock in the morning, on weekdays or weekends, when most of the other leagues around the world were on lockdown. MLS created the bubble. And there was a lot of anticipation. There was a lot of excitement going into this because I think a lot of people thought, okay, hey, could this work for MLS? I mean, is the issue the timing of the games? Is the issue that if we went ahead and played games in the morning as a test, would those games generate as much TV viewing numbers as a Watford against Liverpool or whichever team it is, or Juventus against Roma, or whatever team it is from Europe? And the reality is when those numbers came back, those numbers were poor, really, really poor. I think a lot of those games were less than 100,000 viewers. A lot of people were on lockdown, had nothing to do, weren't working. And those numbers they weren't positive, Kartik. They were not positive at all. So given that, what does that tell you?
I still think it's an issue because for me, I am kind of burnt out and want to watch a movie or do something else by the time, let's say, the last Serie A matches and last La Liga matches end. But yeah, you're right. MLS is back. The ratings weren't great, so that proves maybe in general it's a different. It comes down to interest and quality and maybe the quality of presentation among other things. I don't know, because I also think MLS, the big part of the problem is that there's no real continuity or feel to many of these teams. And while we're now 20, 25 plus years in for nine of the clubs, we are all, although many of them have changed their names and their branding, right, in that period, we're also constantly getting new clubs added to the league every year, and they're not organic clubs that are promoted with a fan base and a history and all of that. So I still think until MLS stabilizes and looks the same for several successive years and players aren't moving around so frequently, there isn't an expansion draft every year, et cetera, it's probably not going to change a whole lot.
I think one thing to think about or to consider is the equity that's built up into supporting a team. So, for example, if you take an average American soccer fan who lives in the United States, and he or she supports Everton. And maybe he or she also supports an MLS team, and maybe it's NYCFC. And this person lives in, I don't know, middle America, far away from NYCFC, far away from Everton. And what's their level of support for those teams? I mean, how much have they put into supporting Everton versus put into supporting NYCFC? Have they been supporting Everton a lot longer? Maybe it's 10 years versus NYCFC, which maybe, say, hypothetically, is maybe 3 years. And for a person living in the middle America who's far away from both of those places, yes, closer to New York City, but still far, far away where he or she probably can't go to those games, I mean, does that person have more access to news about Everton, to discussing Everton, you know, at his or her place where he or she works, at the water cooler, talking about how Everton did last weekend in that game, blah, 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 while maybe perhaps there's less people talking about NYCFC? I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it, too, is NYCFC to this person would just be, I mean, there's no difference between NYCFC and Everton, even though that team is in the United States and the other team is in England. If anything, probably access to news and information and sharing stories and going to a local pub to watch a Everton game on the weekend versus going to a pub, or a bar in his or her town to watch a NYCFC game, chances are pretty good that there would be more Everton fans in that pub than there would be NYCFC fans at that bar or restaurant. I don't think that the national appeal of a team like Everton would be far greater than the national appeal for a NYCFC. Now, if you live in New York City and you happen to go to the games at Yankee Stadium and you become a season ticket holder and you go there, you're chanting, having a beer, meeting new friends, that's a whole completely different experience. But when it comes to watching it on television, there aren't a lot of competitive advantages to having NYCFC in the same country as where you live versus like Everton. Everton, it could be a team anywhere in the world. It could be a team in Asia or something like that. You may feel more of an attachment to that team for whatever reason. And maybe, too, also, you might be a big fan of Tim Howard or Landon Donovan and all these Americans who have played with Everton that may have more of a connection, closer connection for you to that team than it would NYCFC, which just seems to be just another team. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, Sakati, and I'll move on to the next item of news in our listener mailbag segment, and that comes from Bill. Bill says, fans are slowly being allowed back to matches in both Argentina and Brazil, bringing a much-needed atmosphere to those games. The problem is, Paramount Plus still has their commentators pushed up way too high on the audio mix, with the crowd noise way too low. The crowd atmosphere is the best part of South American soccer. Now that the fans are back, the commentators should be able to let the game breathe more and talk less. And that's something probably, Kartik, that a lot of commentators have probably been so used to being either the solo commentator or being so used to, in the last couple of years, commentating with no fans in the stadium or also limited fans in the stadium. Or it might be just their style. Their style is to talk more. And not that the fans, which that's such a huge, important piece of the puzzle, is letting the fans, letting the game breathe, giving spaces of time in a broadcast. John Champion does this perfectly as far as letting the fans speak. Sometimes they can speak louder than any words that John could say. All right, next up is Asian coverage. This comes from Chris. Chris says, "Hi, guys. I wanted to give a huge shout-out to Paramount Plus for stepping up to the U.S. home of both the AFC Asian World Cup qualifiers and the AFC Champions League. The coverage has been excellent so far with both competitions. While we're talking about Asian football, I have a question about the upcoming A-League season. My question to either of you is, does ESPN Plus have the rights for this season? Keep up the good work." And I don't believe they do, Chris. I'd have to check on this. I don't believe they do. So that one is up in the air. And it could possibly be going into Paramount Plus. I know they've got a lot of rights in the Australasia area. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. Next up is Matt. Matt says some feedback about the Women's UEFA Champions League. Matt says, "I'm sending this after the first match day of the UEFA Women's Champions League coverage. And I was very, very impressed by DAZN's and UEFA's coverage of the UEFA Women's Champions League so far. Overall, what a huge improvement on the competition's seriousness by UEFA as a whole. As someone who watched the Chelsea women's side trying to find the right stream to watch the game was a nightmare last season, the ease of accessibility of the Women's UEFA Champions League was a huge welcoming change by UEFA and DAZN being broadcasted through YouTube. I am very optimistic this competition can grow." Kartik, I think you mentioned last week, I think you watched some of the games, but have you had a chance to watch any more of their coverage?
No, I just watched that first match day. So, but I am planning on watching more.
Okay. If you've got something that you want to ask us on the show, we'd love to read your comment out on air. So whether it's any feedback on anything we've discussed, any questions about television coverage or streaming coverage, We would love to hear from you. You can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com in the podcast thread for the latest episode. Also, Kyle wanted me to mention, too, that so we have the interviews coming up pretty soon with Christian Polanco from The Cooligans, as well as Derek Ray from ESPN, NBC, Fox, and FIFA 22 video game, and many other places. And but we want to also find out if there's any guests that you would recommend for us to interview. So ideally, it's in the soccer media business. But let us know if there's anyone out there that you'd really appreciate us interviewing. Kartik, what about you? Any recommendations of somebody that you'd like to hear from on the Soccer Show and Tell show?
Plenty of people, and I'm looking forward to the Cooligans interview. I think that'll be really cool. I think Herc Gomez would be a good one.
Ooh, yeah, that would be a good one.
He brings it for on Football Americas. And all his appearances, I think he'd be a good one. And I think Kyle will have a lot of fun with him.
Yeah, it's really refreshing hearing Herc, too. We interviewed him, about 2 to 3 years ago. Again, time, who knows, it might have been longer. But kind of in his earlier days at the time working with ESPN. And I think at the time also he was working with Fox. And we said to him, hey, we love your analysis. We love how direct you are. We love how you speak your mind. We love how you basically tell it the way it is. And you've got a lot of knowledge. We definitely value you as an analyst. And we wish you the best of luck in the future. And I think he's gone on to bigger and better things already. And he continues to impress me. He's one of the guys, which is not that many around, who really, really speaks his mind and just, you know, doesn't seem to care. I mean, you could tell that some of the things he talks about kind of cuts through a lot of the chatter and goes straight to the heart of the point and is very direct. And that I like about him. That I think, I agree, Kartik. I think he would be a great recommendation for a future episode. All right, listeners, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. We release it every week, usually on Thursdays, on your devices, everything from Amazon Music, Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, Overcast, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. We would greatly appreciate it. Actually, I should say it's probably Apple Podcasts now is where you do the reviews rather than iTunes. And Kartik, the international break is over, thankfully. We're heading into another weekend of club football, and it's hopefully going to be the start of a very interesting month, because later this month, a lot of huge derbies coming up. Manchester United against Liverpool is one that I have my eye on. This Sunday is Swansea City against Cardiff City in the Welsh derby, and that one I'm really, really not looking forward to. It's not a great experience as a fan, because there's so much on the line. And it's a game that ends up being sometimes pretty dour, and because it means so much. But I will watch it, and I will hope that they win. But heading into another weekend of club football from around the world, Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.